Welcome back to the Discovering Forestry podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Corey Lofi, alongside my friend, Joe Aitken. Joe, what's going on?
Another day in paradise, Corey. You know, we talked about our last podcast, but I truly do love this time of the year. Not sure back in your neck of the woods, but here we got leaves. We got trees turning. We have a special guest tonight. In the last couple of days, we were driving around, but we even pulled over and checked out a few trees to kind of see what's going on. It's just, it's early fall. Trees are saved up for the season and they're shutting down already. So it was pretty amazing. And it kind of lines up to a lot of stuff we talked about, but man, I love this time of the year. I love harvest. I love fall colors. This is my favorite time of the year.
And it's such a good time of the year for other people who are outside of our industry to take that drive, to be that leaf peeper, and to acknowledge some of the beautiful color that we have going on in our forest. So I'm glad you're getting a chance to do that, Joe. I have as well taken a couple of hikes, and just, it's a good time of year to take inventory, have an Oktoberfest, and, kind of get prepared for the winter.
Now that, you know, cause you're originally a Midwestern boy, grew up Wisconsin-ish. But now in Colorado, is it the same color, or is the tree palette out there that much different that you don't get the vibrant sugar maples and the picture perfect cider mill, brilliant orange or red maple in the background? Is that out there?
You know, where we live in the mountains, we only have one color for the most part, and that's yellow from either the cottonwoods or the aspens. But down in Denver, you'll see some maples. Maples in Denver typically start turning yellow or orange around July 1st. But if they're doing the seasonal change, they'll be starting any day now.
Okay. Now, it's interesting how often we talk about location, right plant, right spot, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and I was in Arizona last week and got to see a couple cottonwoods starting to change color, some willows on the side of the creek bed starting to turn. But once again, it's yellow. Once you get back to the Midwest where you really have those red sugar maples, and then where you are, oaks as well.
Oh, the red oaks. We have such a wide, diverse treescape that, yeah, the colors are, you could sit up in the woods. And there's even trees that are still green. So you got the greens, the yellows, the oranges, the purples, and it's just amazing. So I'm excited about that. I think within the next week or so, we should have a scientific discussion on why that happens.
Let's do it.
But for tonight, I've been very fortunate to be traveling with one of our colleagues, Kevin Lewis. And we'll let Kevin Lewis introduce himself, tell a little bit about his background. But we were talking as we were driving around, and this has been another topic that's came up very recently in some of the Michigan education tracks through MGIA. And there's a really good turf professor at Michigan State, Dr. Frank. I'm forgetting his last name. I hope to God I remember before the podcast is up so I can give him all the credit. But can trees and turf survive together? So you and I are arboriculture, and we'll let Kevin introduce himself and explain. You know what? I think, and I won't speak for him, we'll let him introduce himself, but I think he's just as big as a dork for turf as we are about trees.
I hope so.
So, Kevin, welcome to the podcast. I've known you for a long time, and I'm proud to work with you, and I'm proud to have you as your friend, and I'm very excited to have you on our podcast tonight. So introduce yourself. Let us know how did you get to where you're at, and let's start there.
Awesome.
Say hi.
Well, thank you, Joe Aitken. I appreciate you having me on. It's an honor to be on this podcast, although I feel like at this point, now that we're talking turf, your listenership is going to drop off dramatically because my interests don't lie in arbor care.
Well, not very strong, but come on, everybody loves trees.
I mean, you guys are sitting there talking about, you know, vibrant colors of trees, whereas we just want to mow those leaves off or blow those leaves off so we can still see our green turf. We want those leaves to go away.
Now, we're not talking a golf course, but you know what? We laugh. It's not just a golf course, but you're right. In an urban setting, and this is a big thing we're going to touch on later, is that you're right. We remove that. But
yep.
A little bit about yourself. How did you, where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school?
Okay. I went to school in Northeast Ohio, just a suburb of Cleveland. I actually finished my senior year in a horticulture program and then moved on to Ohio State and got
the Ohio State.
This podcast is over. Thank you folks so much for joining.
I'm not one of those the Ohio State guys, but I was really never meant to go to college out of high school. So I was on the 10-year program. I quit about partway through and then finished up 10 years later. So I was much more interested in golf just because I enjoyed the game. But once I started working in golf in high school, just being around the equipment was the thing for me. You know, I was a boy. I just wanted to be around equipment. I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. And that's what really brought me kind of more into the business, because I just wanted to be around that, all the mowing equipment and things like that. But as time went on, just seeing some of the management practices that we did on the golf course really amazed me, and understanding what it took and the kind of really the kind of dedication it took from superintendents to be the best in their business. I mean, it wasn't a 9-to-5 job. It wasn't a 40-hour a week job. It was 7 days a week. It was, you know, 6-8 months without a day off. And you were there from dark to dark on a pretty routine basis.
How long did you say you were super into golf?
I was super for 12 years, but I spent 20 years total in golf.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's awesome.
Yep. I was on my way to becoming a certified superintendent, and then things just kind of fell apart, and I kind of hit a wall, and I said, listen, I'm done. So at that point, even though I really enjoyed what I did, I was really burned out, because again, it's a lot of long hours. And another associate of ours had called me from John Deere Landscapes at that time, JB Torish, and said, we've got an opening in technical services, and you're strong on turf, I'm strong on tree and ornamental. Why don't you join up with us? So I saw that as being a really great opportunity. And I jumped on board with John Deere Landscapes and really had the opportunity to learn a lot more than just turf. I was very turf focused. I knew how to climb a tree. I took arboriculture classes in college, but they weren't my focus. So they kind of were in the back of my mind, and I didn't call on a lot of those skills or diagnostics or anything else like that for a long time. But once I joined up into tech, I was really expanding my understanding of a lot more of the green industry, including everything from pest control to landscape ornamentals and trees and things like that, and really broadened my horizons to the point where I said, you know, I feel like I can be, some of the things that I've done and some of the things I've learned can be more of an asset through other parts of the green industry. And I wanted to find a cause to work with, and that cause was water conservation. I spent a lot of years trying to manage water on the golf course and understanding how important water was to plant material, and understanding also the value of water throughout communities that either have low availability to water or the cost of water was very high. And that's what really drew me to Ecology All. They had a really unique technology that we could work together to keep plants healthy, but maintain water savings or water efficiency all at the same time.
Yeah, you know, and I think Corey and I in past podcasts, we've talked about the value of water and the four building blocks of plants. One thing that I don't think, you know, people understand is that turf is a photosynthesizing plant, just as a tree is. And you think about the square foot, I'm hoping this will direct us into what I wanted to talk to Kevin about, because, you know, when I hear you describe this, when we're out visiting customers and, you know, talking to distributors, it's riveting to me that we have a hard time connecting the two. But all living plants on Earth need A, B, and C to survive. So why not turf? So tonight we are kind of like, you know, we talked about, I think it's Dr. Kevin Frank. I knew it would come to me. Can trees and turf survive together? So in an urban landscape, now if you, Corey, if you were to walk out into a forest, thick, heavy, middle to older age forest, there's nothing growing on the ground.
Right. Can't be so thick, right? You wouldn't have turf.
So they're missing one of the key elements, which is sunlight. It's the canopy's too thick. But even then, in an urban setting, everybody wants that grass right up to the base of the tree. And me as an arborist is like, oh no, back that beep up, you know, get it back there. Recreate the urban or the forest floor in an urban setting. So where's that line? So this is the expertise on our podcast that we want to pick Kevin's brain on.
I have a question right off the bat is can we discuss what are the water demands and what are the nutrient demands of turf versus trees, and however you want to tackle that fastball thrown right at you, Kevin?
Sure. Absolutely. And you are without a doubt 100% correct in understanding the nutritional as well as water demands that a fine stand of turf require. However, if you look at more of your low maintenance turf grasses that can withstand much lower fertility inputs, things like buffalo grass and some of your native tall fescues, not your turf type tall fescues, but your native tall fescues, most of those plants can withstand periods of low moisture. They can withstand much lower fertility inputs and can be a preferable plant to some of your higher maintenance turf grasses. So, I mean, there's options there. I mean, people have, you know, one vision of a turf grass, and that's that finely mowed stripe in a lawn, whereas there are several other lawn cover grasses that don't require that type of maintenance.
And I think it's important for people to discover and to understand that when we're talking about turf, if you go buy a bag of seed from the Home Depot, it's going to come as a variety. It's so much ryegrass, bluegrass, whatever else is in there. So
can I add to that, Corey, real quick?
Sure.
Trees. We talk about this so many times in our podcast, that right tree, right spot. Is turf geographically categorized?
Absolutely. I mean, you look across the country and across our hardiness zones, and you've got a cool season area, you've got a transition area, and you've got a warm season area. And each one of those, you will have specific species of turf grasses that will thrive in those areas. Absolutely.
So there are, obviously, so say we went into one of our large distributors, the turf, the bags of seed that we see here in Michigan is going to be different than the bags of seed we'd see in Arizona.
Without a doubt. And most times you're not even going to see bags of seed in Arizona, because most of your warm season turf grasses are not, they're not seed derived. They're more vegetatively planted, whether it be sprigs or sod or plugs or whatever the case may be.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. Particularly, well, you will see some Bermuda grass seed and occasionally, very occasionally, some zoysia grass seed, but most of those are vegetatively reproducing.
Wow. That's awesome. So, all right. So yeah, I learned something new. Already.
Turf guy.
Blown away by Kevin Lewis. And I think another requirement, now this is something that I found out through the years, is that there's soil, different types of soil requirements. Now we're talking about just the types of plants. Now let's go below grade. Now you think about soil requirements for turf versus soil requirements for trees. Now we all know that the root horizon is obviously different. But is there a difference in the fungi and the bacterial count in turf versus trees?
And that's a great question. So I really honestly believe that in most cases, turf grasses tend to be more adaptable than woody species or dicotyledonous plants, because you can grow them on just about anything. You know, you've seen weedy grasses growing up through the cracks of your sidewalk. Can you grow a tree there?
Every now and then, one surprises you.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's rare.
Tree of heaven, yeah, something like that.
There's weedy trees that can do it.
Turf grasses seem to be very tenacious and very adaptable, so they can grow most places. And granted, if you want to have a fine stand of turf, whether it's an athletic field or a golf course, you may look at doing some soil composition adjustments. But, you know, look at how many new housing developments that are out there that they literally scrape off all the topsoil. They may come back with an inch of topsoil and they're planting turf grasses in those areas. And they seem to do just fine for the most part. So they're very adaptable for those areas. I mean, we plant turf grasses on hillsides, on highway medians and things like that to prevent erosion. And they put up with those types of situations. Really the biggest things that you look at from an environmental perspective on turf grass performance is mostly shade and water.
Okay. So you're talking shade as an adverse.
Shade is an adverse. Most cool season turf grasses require 4 to 6 hours of sunlight daily.
Wow. So there's an issue right there. That's why when we talk, Corey, when we go to golf courses, we try to talk trees to golf courses, like no, if it's sick, it's gone. We need to get rid of trees.
Yeah, it was in the way of the 9-pole.
Or no, it's shading the turf because golf courses are green.
Exactly. Well, not only shading the turf, but then you get competition for water. So there's numerous superintendents that'll take a trencher through root zones to cut tree roots, just so you get more water availability to the turf.
Can we talk about that a little bit more, Kevin Lewis? So when the homeowner will say, yeah, my tree gets water, I water the grass for, you know, each zone gets 30 minutes three times a week or every day. How much of that is actually getting to the roots of the trees?
A very small amount. So there are four basic fates of water, whether it's irrigation or rainfall. Water can run off, it can be used by the plant, it can be leached through the soil, or it can be lost to evaporation. When you water for 30 minutes, you're basically creating what we try to call field capacity. And field capacity is based on where the root zone for the turf grasses are, which is generally in that 2 to 4 inch zone. A matter of fact, when you're doing soil testing for turf grasses, you don't want to be any deeper than 4 inches because now you're sampling area where the turf grass root is not growing. So you don't care about what nutrients are down there. So we know that watering to fill that first 2 to 4 inches of root zone is critical in order to maintain enough moisture for turf grass survival. Whereas tree roots, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16 inches down, whatever the case may be, your typical turf grass irrigation cycles are going to do zero for trees.
Are they, yeah, what Corey says, you know, we supply or we work with one of the largest distributors in the North America. Are we designing irrigation systems for trees now?
Very infrequently. I can't honestly say that I've ever seen one on site anywhere.
Interesting, because that was a great question, Corey. You know, most people in an urban landscape run the zones. They think everything's getting watered. Grass looks great. Trees are struggling. And when I did the tree climbing championship this weekend, we had our Autumn Arbor Fest the Wednesday and Thursday before. So I was involved with this event for 5 days. And there was a great question that came up about the stress on a plant, you know, say an acorn producing oak, or the evergreens in the Midwest are just this year for some reason are just enormously abundant on seed, which is an indicator of stress. So Dr. Bert Craig was there, Michigan State, and I asked him about this, and he goes, "It's a stress, and it's not a stress as today or this year. It could be the reaction of a stress from 12, 14, 15 years ago that's finally catching up where the tree's saying, shoot, I think I'm still dying, boom, overseeds." Now, turf doesn't. Is now trees have tropisms that react to external stimuli. You know, there's a lot of crap going on inside the urban landscape and forestry. Does turf react to tropisms? Does turf react to external pressures?
Absolutely.
Or is it a little simpler?
It's much simpler in the fact that the reaction to stresses that you're going to see are nearly immediate. So it's not anything that you're dealing with 10, 12, 14 years down the road. And a lot of that is too, because you're not seeing those same plants hanging around. Some of those plants die off, other plants move in. You're getting species that are changing some of the areas of the lawn or the turf grass stand. So you're not seeing that same plant over and over again. You're seeing new plants a lot of times.
Is turf an annual or a perennial?
Most turf grasses are perennials. However, we will have some loss due to summer stresses or winter stresses, and yet the stoloniferous and rhizomaceous turf grasses will grow new plants up in between.
So that was I had a question for you, and it was pretty interesting. So if we took one seed of grass in a pot, and you watered it, what is the longevity of a turf plant?
So, I mean, there are some that are more of a weak perennial, but it really depends on the environmental stresses that you put it through.
This goes right back to the reason I wanted to have you on here, is that can we all survive together? So a turf plant, so you take, I'm talking a single seed, single pot, and if you maintained it, could you put that out of your windowsill or your kitchen and water it regularly and have that last forever?
More or less, yeah, absolutely. And see, the turf grass plant also has more of a defense mechanism where it's called dormancy. So under extreme stress, whether it be winter cold stress or summer heat stress, it'll go into a dormant period where you see the yellowing or browning of the leaf. And the leaf really is not that big of a deal for the plant, because the brain center, that area that generates all that energy and stores all that energy, is actually just at the soil level. And that's called the crown of the plant. Cool. So, you know, those of you that have not had, or don't kind of keep your finger on the pulse of the turf grass industry, we've had a massive outbreak of an invasive that basically they're suspecting blew the adults of this fall armyworm blew up into the jet stream and were pushed up here by hurricanes, but they have never ever shown their face in the Midwest.
Wow.
And this goes along with your question, so I'm not getting too far off topic here.
Oh no, keep going.
And these army worms will reproduce, you know, each female can lay, you know, 30 to 50 eggs or 30 to 80 eggs, something like that. But the reproduction of this thing is outrageous. And once you see this whole mass of these worms out there, they could turn a green lawn into a brown lawn literally overnight. But they're eating the leaf. Okay. So that's leaving the crown healthy. And if we continue to water that crown, we could end up with a green lawn again in just a couple of weeks.
Wow. That's you kind of steered me in a path that I didn't make a note for, but Corey, you and I deal a lot in invasives in arboriculture and forestry, insects and diseases. We don't hear much of invasives in turf. There's got to be, you know, we think about Pangea and the continents were all together millions of years ago. Now, there has to be invasive insects and diseases come over affecting turf that we're discovering regularly. Is there, you know, we all talk about the Asian longhorn beetle, emerald ash borer, everything's coming over because of the trade from Asia. Is that bringing over issues for turf also?
So I don't know that it's necessarily been pinpointed on trade lines. However, we do have some new emerging insects, and we have weeds that are becoming herbicide. I'll come up with the word here in a minute, but they become less sensitive to some of the herbicides. So we have annual bluegrass that some of them are less sensitive to herbicides. We have insects that are becoming less sensitive to some of the insecticides. And we are seeing some emergence of new insects that we've not battled in the past. So annual bluegrass weevil is one of them that really kind of was speckled around the Northeast for a little while, and it's made its way all the way to the Midwest. It's become a massive pest on annual bluegrass. And let's face it, most golf courses, you know, they're not a pure stand of creeping bentgrass. Most of them are 30 to 50 to 70, even 90% annual bluegrass greens. And this is because of its complex life cycle, becomes a very, very difficult pest to manage. And they become resistant to our typical insecticides as well.
So, all right. So there's nothing like, so we think, oh my God, emerald ash borer. You know, you think about a pest like that. Now, you're talking a tree, a bug, you know, a problem, a solution. There's nothing that says, oh my God, that's the Asian turf worm or no. Something that's like, you know what I'm trying to get to?
I do. I mean, there are mutations within diseases. There are, I just looked at pictures of weeds from Northeast Ohio that are some sedge that we've never even heard of before, but it's creeping in on a green.
So how did it get there? Where did it come from?
Absolutely.
Where's it? Yeah. That's interesting. I think that's going to be a big play in the future. And I don't think that I'm an arborist, Kevin. I'm an arborist through and through my whole life. You know, you're sitting in the lair here and you're surrounded by arboriculture. I don't know if we give the smaller plants in the environment enough credit. Let's, you know, as we get near towards the end of the podcast, let's talk about the value, the environmental value that turf provides.
Absolutely.
And how does it benefit trees? That's what we want to know.
but it's a big system. And
it
I
is.
Want to know,
it's all connected.
It is. Yeah. Cut it down, mow it out, till it up, more mulch.
But, you know, you got to remember, too, and I appreciate and understand the value of trees, but I also appreciate and understand the value of turf grasses. You could have all the trees you want, but if we don't have a lawn for your kids to play in, if we don't have, you know, you think about athletic fields and you think about what I like to call fake grass, carpet, plastic grass, whatever the case may be. Guys are getting hurt more in professional and collegiate athletics, even high school athletics. Because they're playing on plastic grass. They're playing on a surface that can be 60 to 80 degrees hotter than the ambient temperature around them. That really kind of resounds.
Doesn't that fake turf carry a disease or a bacterium that athletes get really sick off?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I believe you can get any number of viruses from that, and you still have to spray these with antiviral compounds in order to keep them clean. But at the end of the day, I mean, the vision, and it's not every generation, but many generations had that vision of coming home to that nice green lawn in front of their house, or having that area where your kids could play kickball or tag or chase lightning bugs or whatever the case may be. But having that nice, soft, cool area that also, you know, gave your home some of that aesthetic value, that curb appeal that you see from a nice lawn.
So I want to, you know, I want to, I'm not trying to stop you because I know where you're going, the aesthetics. More people on a day-to-day pay to have their lawn green than they will the trees. Now that's a hazard or a hurdle that we overcome in arboriculture. The grass is perfect, the trees look like shit.
And then the homeowner says the same thing. Well, I water and fertilize the turf. The tree's got to be fine.
But, and I'm glad you brought that back up. Let me intervene here. What's funny, when you go back to talking about watering the turf, now you've got sprinklers blasting the trunk of the tree, keeping the trunk of the tree wet, which is even more detrimental to the tree.
Right.
Didn't I just say something nice about trees?
it's being recorded, so yes. But is turf a photosynthetic plant?
Absolutely.
Does that absorb carbon?
Yeah.
Is it have, and what? Obviously, a big mature tree versus a turf grass. The catch word now is carbon absorption, carbon sequestering. Mm-hmm. Is that part of turf?
Absolutely. As well as heavy metals that are in the air.
All right.
And I think it's also important, and this kind of goes back just a couple of minutes, and I know we're trying to wrap it up, but as an arborist, as a tree physiologist here, I look at new growth that comes onto a tree. And it only happens in three places: the root caps, the meristems, the buds, and then the cambial region. New growth within turf is happening, like you said earlier, at the crown.
Right.
So how you manage it is completely different. People just think, oh, I'm just mowing out. It's always going to grow right off the top. It's actually growing from near that soil level.
Correct.
So they're as close as these are to plants, they are so vastly apart in how we need to manage them.
And to answer Joe's statement about having lawn services, you know, oftentimes these lawn services are doing the wrong things at the wrong time as well. So the grass may look green on the top, but it's requiring more maintenance because we're not developing a well, a good biology in the soil
and to increase environment
for root development so that we can reduce some of those inputs.
So it's all connected at least that way. Exactly.
Yes. That's awesome.
Ties the picture together. I love it.
But at the end of the day, done properly, we can coincide. We have for a few years now. But
yeah, there's different requirements, but
it takes an education.
Yeah. Kevin, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on today. It was really fun to for Corey and I to take a different direction on the green industry. And I think all of our listeners will benefit from what we talked about tonight. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Kevin, so much. Really appreciate it. Really appreciate all the listeners sharing our podcast, passing it on to their friends, family, grandparents, what have you. Thank you so much. Until next time.
Hey, great topic today.
Yes, and lots of good information.
Yeah, probably one of our best yet.
If you enjoyed the podcast or have topics you would like to discuss, please send them to discoveringforestry@gmail.com. And please hit the subscribe button and tell a friend.
Thanks, guys, for tuning in. Until next time, I'm Joe.
And I'm Corey.
Signing out.